Welcome to One House. Today, our guest is Court Desitel. Court is the president, is that right?
President.
Chief bottle washer, is that I've seen?
Really, or, chief dishwasher.
Yeah, of the neighborhood group. And we are broadcasting from the University of Guelph today, from Guelph, Ontario. And that is where Court's neighborhood group of restaurants is headquartered. And there's four restaurants in this area. I've been to them all, love them all, and keeps you a busy guy.
It sure does.
Well, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. I want to expand on the intro a little bit because it's deserving. And I'm going to frame this by looking back on my restaurant career, and it's been about almost 10 years since I've been out of the business, but in my last job, as you know, I was in a position similar to yours, not quite as high up and as important, but was running the operations of a multi-unit company, and the team I was working with, we were pretty proud, worked hard at pushing the envelope of trying different things, but we always did so within the established 67-year-old restaurant, full-service restaurant business model. So, you know, really, we were doing things different than other people, but we really weren't being innovative and we weren't changing things. And I think that's what impresses me most about you and your team at the Neighborhood Group is you're really creating a new model as you go, and you're really not adhering to, again, that 60-year-old business model. You're making a new one, and it's inspiring from a distance watching, and I know how much effort your team puts into it and how much thought and energy. So we're excited to have you here. I take my hat off to you for doing such a great job, and I think, you know, it's been a big year for you. You welcomed your second child, Harvey, into the world. I know you won some award from the Ontario Hostler Institute, which was pretty amazing. But most importantly, from your company's point of view, you became B Corp certified. And maybe you can, before I get into my questioning, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about what B Corp is and then give us a Reader's Digest version of your journey to attaining that.
Sure. It was quite a journey. And the journey actually started a long time ago from some of your teachings, believe it or not, when we went to meet you at one of the restaurants. And it was kind of looking at a more holistic approach to service and looking at all the different touch points. And it was that's what was kind of the catalyst in getting more involved with not the people who were just the guests that were coming in the restaurant, but the people who were involved with the guests and making it happen. That was all the team, all the staff that were working in the restaurants. And that's when it started to dawn on me from working in the restaurant business for so long that we're always focusing on the guests. It's all about the guests. It's all about the guests. You do whatever it is about the guests, and the guests are the ones that are paying the bill.
Yep.
And it was almost the staff became it was a commodity.
Yeah.
No. And I felt that way.
Personally,
you bend over backwards for everybody,
yeah,
and you did what you had to do to make people happy, and I never found I was very happy myself.
Yeah.
I was never really satisfied with what we were doing, and that's from me being a kid growing up in the business, from working in kitchens until, you know, from when I was 13.
Because your dad started this company,
and you worked. He's the one who's he's a true visionary,
yeah,
and. But when I got out of our company working in other kitchens, I hated it. I never wanted to be in the restaurant ever again.
Yeah.
And my mission was to get out of it, and I've always got sucked back in.
Yeah.
And it's something that I realized I couldn't escape. So if I can't escape it, I'm going to try to change it and use a lot of teachings from a lot of mentors I've had over the time, and my father being the biggest one. But it was, you know, as we started creating this journey, we were doing, my father would always give us some readings to do at our manager summits. And one was from Yvon Chouinard, founder of Patagonia.
Yeah, Let My People Go Surfing. He gave me that book. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell everyone that listening to this that you should you should read that book.
You really should.
It is a great book.
Yeah. So that really changed my whole entire focus of what, you know, running a sustainable business mm-hmm. really means mm-hmm. and the purpose of business mm-hmm. and the people who actually make it happen. Mm-hmm. And so in that book I read about a B Corporation.
Yep.
I went, wow, this sounds kind of interesting.
And how many years is this, Court?
Well, we're...
How many years ago?
This is 6 years ago.
Okay.
And immediately after finishing reading the book, I thought, this is the future of where business needs to go.
Yeah.
And if we're going to survive, and if we're going to make any kind of create any change, there has to be some kind of element that holds us accountable for it. And going through the whole B Corp certification and just reading about it, I knew that was the direction that we had to go in. So went through the process from the online assessment, which is free.
Right.
For anybody to go right. and take, right. which is crazy.
Yeah.
And it gives you an incredible amount of tools and a lot of metrics to start measuring yourself. And it really laid a foundation of how we're going to do it. And I went through it. I got halfway through the assessment and I said, there is no chance in hell that we are going to get this.
Yeah.
We really need to refocus on how we're going to be as a company,
right?
What we're going to turn ourselves into,
right?
Because the way that a hospitality industry, which is kind of ironic because it's all about hospitality, but others,
yeah, no,
except for ourselves,
yeah,
and start looking at all these different areas in the business that we need to make a drastic change in, and I think a lot of it was like the welfare of our employees,
yeah,
of our teams,
because you had. You know, your father, starting with your father, and he's famous for being the first restaurateur in this province and probably the country for embracing local produce, beverages, and that's well documented. And you guys had Bullfrog Power and environmentally and in the community, you were doing the Speed River Conservation, and those things were in place.
Green since 2006.
So this was the evolution of beyond the environmental sustainability, more to the social and the economic.
It was, because that's the hard part. We always talk about sustainability and we're always thinking
green.
You know, it's green. And it's about the energy we're consuming, the food that we're serving. And, you know, we have local foods on our menu and local drinks. So we've got it all covered. And, you know, we had those elements. We were a great, huge component in the community. Trying to be big advocates about environmental initiatives and obviously, you know, champions of working with local farmers mm-hmm. and brewers and winemakers. But it was all about the employees. And so going through the assessment, I was going, okay, we've got the environmental aspects. So, okay, we're pretty good. We're not tracking a lot of the impact that we have, but we can do that.
Yep.
And then start looking about the food and drink component or how it fits into the model. Because obviously, being a B Corporation doesn't mean you have to be a restaurant. It covers, was it 56? I think it's actually even higher now, 70 different industries or so. And, you know, it's they've now launched, there's B Corporations in about 45 to 55 different countries.
That's great.
In the world. And when we started that process, there was less than... You know, this is going back 6 years ago. I think there was less than maybe 500 to 700 B Corporations. Now we're about 2,200.
Wow.
In time frame.
But and it will continue to
it's gaining more momentum.
It is, yeah.
You know, US is obviously where it started in Philadelphia, which is a whole other story of how it started, which maybe we'll do another
one day.
and then, you know, Canada was the next country that started adopting it. And now Australia is catching up quickly to Canada. And Australia is just pounding them out right now.
Yep.
And so we got a lot of work to do, Canada, if you're listening. And but it started looking at, you know, what impact for our governance and how we were doing with employees.
Right.
There's another area too. So the areas are, you know, community, mm-hmm. Employees, mm-hmm. governance, environment, and there's also customers, which we don't have a direct impact on customers. Even though customers buy things, there's no direct correlation. If you buy something from us, we're giving X amount to a certain cause.
Gotcha.
It's like 1% for the planet or you know, we like to kind of keep that money and decide if we're going to donate what projects
where
to,
it goes.
To specifically.
Yeah.
And so we just don't have that component for us. And, but going through that, I said, you know, employees, we don't do anything besides think that we had a pretty good culture at the time.
Right.
But we paid the same as everybody else. We, you know, same turnover as everyone else and, you know, same problems everyone else had. And we were just thinking, that's just an issue.
Just the way it is. It's the industry.
That's how it goes. That's how I grew up.
Always been that way. It'll always be.
We just plan for it. We just plan for high turnover and, you know, there's always going to be a crisis every once in a while and you deal with it. But that's what's making everybody so tired.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why everyone's leaving the industry. So there's that component saying we have a lot of work to do. And then there was governance. Mm-hmm. And it's really about being transparent and the influence people have in a lot of our decision making, which we didn't. You know, it's always been a very, it's a dictatorship almost working in restaurants.
You know, generally
that's
just it is.
How it works. You know, it's very militant. And, you know, I tell you to do this, and that's how it happens. And so there's not a lot of discussion. So we started changing a lot of the ways that we started focusing on our business. And as typical neighborhood group fashion, we said, this is what we're going to do, and who cares what it's going to cost?
Right.
Right? This is the right thing to do. And so it took us about 4 years to make those changes through a variety of different challenges, you know, from investors not wanting to get on board, which deservedly so, because the restaurants were making a lot of money right then. So, they, you know, now here we're going to go spend money on health benefits for employees.
Right.
And we're going to start creating, you know, start doing a variety of trips and
development
and development and, you know, lawyer fees on changing our articles of incorporation.
Right.
Because we have to incorporate the values of a B corporation. So it was a long journey to get there. And finally, we're almost at 2 years now that we've had.
Is it 2 years?
Almost 2 years. It's coming up in February and we have to recertify.
Yeah.
Which is terrifying.
Yeah.
We have to recertify.
Because you have to improve, don't you? You have to show continuous improvement.
You can't just sit back and say, hey, we're still doing all the great things we were doing before. Our score is going to go down. And the way they the assessment works, it's continually evolving.
And if I am, it was exciting for us because it was our UGSERP forum 2 years ago, 2016, when you announced this publicly, I think, that you had just attained your B Corp. You were gracious enough to be our speaker, one of our speakers that year. And you had mentioned the renewal process. But I think also you mentioned that aren't you the only group of restaurants in Canada that's B Corp certified now?
We're the only group in Canada, which I thought, yes, this is amazing. We're the only group. We're the largest group in the world, actually.
Are you? At four?
At four. We weren't the first group. There's a group out of Michigan, Essence Restaurant Group, and they've actually just added their fourth restaurant. But it dawned on me at first of being this, yes, we're the first restaurant group in Canada, we're the largest in the world, and all of a sudden I sat back and said, that's the most pathetic thing in the world to say. Because there's only two restaurant groups in the planet. There's only only 17 restaurants, and about 10 of them are only full service.
Yeah.
It's pathetic.
And that's a huge difference, and I think we'll get into that full service business model we're going to talk about with the One House, and maybe that's a good segue because you know, full service is in challenging times. I'm sitting across from an operator in full service. There's competition from, you know, limited service or fast casual. More people are taking away what they consider quality food from grocery stores now. So full service is in challenging times as well. So for you to be pushing this new model in these times, I think is great, but I think it's a great moment for you to sort of carve, you know, there, and I don't want to get in trouble by saying this, there's an academic project called The Restaurant of the Future, and they're based out of the Netherlands at a University in the Netherlands, and great, they do a lot of consumer research stuff. But really, I look at you guys, and I think you're really carving out what the restaurant of the future will look like. You're just ahead of the curve, but hopefully, we want everyone else to to catch up.
I hope so, because there's still a lot of parts about our business model that are flawed.
Yeah.
And we need to improve on. And there's some areas I'm terrified of dealing with.
Right.
And we're trying to figure out ways to kind of get around some of these things and how to change the focus of how restaurants do business, but without going too far out of it that we get too far ahead of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a tendency of ours at times. Maybe we get a little too far ahead.
Yeah. And it can bite you.
I don't want to see what my father went through.
Yeah.
You know, from the pub in 1990 to losing a few restaurants and just through people who just didn't buy into the whole concept.
Yeah.
And
that whole ahead of your time being ahead of your time.
When we opened up Borealis too, the first few years were really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost lost everything all over again.
Yeah.
And, I was still a little fledgling at that time. And I really, best education of my life was opening my first restaurant. With my father and our other partner, Aldo. And it was a hellish experience. It was terrible.
I've done 14.
Yeah.
That's why the gray hair, I think that it all came in with the restaurant openings.
And but then there's this weird addiction to
it. Yeah. Oh yeah.
And, and then it's going and doing the second one. I thought it'd be easier and it was easier, but it still had its challenges. Doing having the three restaurants, we always had the pub and then opening up our second Borealis. It was tough, but it was starting to we were starting to figure it out a little bit. And then we opened our fourth, Majida.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that, I thought this will be really easy. and it was a really tough experience, as well. There was a lot of just weird things that were happening all at once,
mm-hmm.
Personally and professionally. And there was but once we opened and had the doors open, all of a sudden things just came really easy.
Mm.
And, I'm not saying it's super easy now because it's always going to be tricky, but I think it's going to lend ourselves to make opening our fifth one that much better, and allow it to grow. Because now we have this, we have a team of people that are like-minded individuals, mm-hmm. that have taken us a while to build since becoming a B Corp. I think it's really changed our philosophy and our mentality as a company.
I think it has.
And
I've noticed that, yep.
And the one thing that's done is it's actually made us more profitable, which seems crazy. If you
say that again, Cord. Everyone listening out there.
If you were to take our business model and go to a bank or some investor, they'd say, absolutely no way.
Yeah.
No, and that's why that was the original thoughts.
Yeah.
Spend more money, helping with benefits and development of people, and more environmental projects and working with other charitable organizations and trying to create some social changes that people want to help you. They want to support your business because of the things you're doing. And also, and I hate to say it sometimes, but if we make mistakes, because we do, people are way more forgiving, right? And I said, I still felt good about going in there.
Yeah,
because I still
that's felt an interesting
like
point.
And so it's allowed us to kind of fumble our way through a couple services and mini flips and all those things that we do all the time,
mm-hmm.
and give us a little more leeway to make it right.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we make a mistake, we're learning from it, and we're getting ourselves that much further ahead of potentially where someone else is trying to say, hey, I like what they're doing, I'm going to try to mimic that.
Well, and it's interesting because I will say that I know this, that you did not go down this journey for profitability. This was because it was the right thing to do, and it was, as you stated a few minutes ago, is who you wanted to be as a company.
Yeah.
And it just so ends up being that profitability comes with this in your case.
It was the best consequence ever.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, and hopefully you can – any do you want to give us any special secrets on when the fifth –
we're looking, and it's funny thing is the people are now coming to us,
mm-hmm.
more than I ever have. And there's usually somebody, you know, once a week reaching out to us.
That's good.
To do it. But for us, it's not just say, oh, you have a space. Great. Let's go. How much is the rent? And let's put a Borealis or a Magitta or another Woolly in there. I think that that space has to be really unique, just like it was at Magitta. And it really needs to be, and I don't know what that exact concept is going to be. I have a few concepts in our brain, or a bunch of us do.
Yeah.
But if the building doesn't speak to what that is, then it's not gonna work. And I think there has to be, it's hard to develop a soul in a building. The building already has to kind of have that soul.
It does.
You might have it hidden, but you have to be able to bring it out somehow. And so, and it's deciding what market to go into. You know, a lot of people are interested in bringing something to Toronto, and I have no interest in going to Toronto.
And being in the restaurant business in Toronto for many years, I would concur with that and say, you might want to.
It's a huge market, and I think we probably do well, but, you know, I could do half the sales in Guelph and make twice the amount of money.
And less headache.
Exactly.
So,
you know. The labor force might be a lot better in Toronto than it is here.
Well, I don't know about that. We can we're touching on a bunch of areas of one house, and since the podcast is Molly's giving me the look here, Bruce, get on one house. That's Molly is our production intern who keeps us in check here. So one house. So you and I have sort of thrown this around, and I'm going to make an assumption that. You agree, or that you agree that in the restaurant business we have divided ourselves into two pieces, the back of house and the front of house, and that those two pieces, and this is a generalist statement, so there's always exceptions, but for the most part, there's a different culture in the back than there is in the front. There's a different compensation model. There's even a different way we design and invest money. Capital in the back of the house versus the front of the house. You know, spend money in guest areas, absolutely. But I can remember going 10, 15 years without putting a cent into a kitchen. Really embarrassingly, I'll admit to it. But so do you agree that maybe somewhere in this divide it's limiting our potential, and that if smart companies figure out how to break down those barriers, maybe unify us, good things will happen. Where do you stand on this whole idea? Because I'm still trying to figure it out, hence this podcast series.
It is it's a big question, and I agree. It's 100% that there is a divide. And whether sometimes it's more prominent in some restaurants than it is in others. You know, going back to our whole journey about becoming a B Corporation was trying to find a better way of bringing people together.
Yeah.
And, you know, you go through this journey and going, okay, we're a B Corp and we've brought more people to the table. More people were listening to everyone's ideas from the back house where we say the heart house.
Yeah.
And that's our one way, you know, we call it different names. So
it's
better. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, doing health benefits for people. We said, this is great. But it really hasn't made any big changes. And I see it in our own restaurants, which is interesting. The Woolly, which is, you know.
It's its own
always,
beast.
It's its got own beast. Yeah. It's everything. But it's always been on a pooled tip system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we love to talk about tips.
No.
But it is.
I did not bring tipping up. I just want to make that clear.
But there's. You know, the tips isn't there for the service staff, because I even find there's a divide with servers as well, too.
For sure there is.
And I think there's more camaraderie within a kitchen than sometimes there are in the service side.
Agreed.
Because the kitchen folks are all working together for one purpose, to get that dish out and fast and quickly and hot or as cold as possible. And
there's also we're hard done by, and you're my brother, and we're together, we got each other's
back. You're going
back.
To battle.
Yeah,
you're going to battle. Sure. You don't hear servers going and like, we're getting ready for battle tonight.
Well, and I've always labeled that we've made this system for our servers mercenary almost, where they're hired guns and they're very individualistic, and their motivations are individualistic, where working in a team in a kitchen, it's very much a team. It always has been. Yeah.
And in the service side, it's hey, that person's got more tables than me. How come I wasn't sat? That person left me no tips.
Yep.
And, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there's always a bit of a fight and, you know, it's always trying to break it down. But the Woolies always had, you know, service have always worked on a pooled system. And I'm still trying to figure out, you know, well, I know the reason why. It's a disease that runs in the industry, but the kitchen were never really included in that pool. They get a percentage of the tip out, mm-hmm. but not the equivalent. And I've crunched some numbers recently, so I can give you some idea of the divide between the two. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But it's with the Woolly, everybody just, you know, the service staff walk out with pretty much a consistent amount of money. Mm-hmm. They know it's X amount of hours that they're working, they're going to get, you know, $23-25 an hour.
Yeah.
Okay. Plus their wage.
Plus their wage, yeah.
And if they come in and it's slow and they get cut, they all have duties. You know, mm-hmm. maybe sweep the basement or it's, you know, polish glassware or take out the garbage or whatever it is. They have a set of duties. So that person who's going to get cut first, they have to do a bunch of duties and they go home. Most restaurants, you get nothing. You just get your server minimum wage and you're out the door.
Yep.
And it was a bust that night. Hopefully you make it back next night.
Yep.
So that person, you know, might get busy later on at night. So those 3 hours that person worked, at least they're getting a portion of the tips that were made in the later part of the evening.
Absolutely.
That they weren't there for.
Yeah.
And it really brought the team together. And it's something that we talked about introducing in some of our other restaurants that we open up.
And let me ask you a question. The turnover at the Woolly and the service staff is low?
Very low.
Compared to your other restaurants?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So I can just give you attrition rates. Mm-hmm. I'll give you, here they are.
Yeah. Right? This is being recorded. Are you
sure you want? I know. It's sometimes
someone
it's
at B-Corp headquarters might be
listening. Our attrition rates at the Woolly run around 15%.
Mm, which is insane
how low that is. The industry average is about 75%.
Yeah.
And some of our restaurants have had as high as 78%.
Yeah.
And as a company as a whole, which is kind of, it's funny, last year we ran around 45% as a company, or sorry, 2 years ago we were 45%. Last year we were 55%.
Hmm.
So we're B Corp, we're good for the world and good for people, and we had a higher turnover rate. A lot of that has to do because we had just opened up
Machida. And when that happens,
there's a little bit of turnover. But it's an embarrassing thing to see, and it's an embarrassing mark on our industry to say, hey, I've just made it under 75%. Like, there's no industry out there. Do we have that rate of turnover?
No, it's...
And... But the Woolly's been this place that has had just, you know, same people. It becomes more of a career because you know what kind of money's coming in. And there are people who have, you know, gone to university and received their degrees and thought, you know, the money's just so great.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you to – the Woolly is – and I don't mean this in a bad way. It is nothing special in its design, but it is very special in its execution. So – you know, it's not a fancy menu. It's not a fancy design or decor,
nope.
But it's a great feeling and it's executed well. And you have competent staff who have been there a long time and nothing ever gets messed up in my orders or anything at the Woolly. And it's because people have stuck around. So there is this relationship between execution and quality and productivity and turnover. And
100%.
Yeah. And that, again, I've always argued that there should be a line on our P&Ls that is retention or attrition or turnover or something that actually says this is how much it costs you. Because we look through our P&Ls and we look at the cost of our dishwashing, you know, detergent and our you know, bank fees and this and our credit card fees. But if we actually looked at the amount of money that turnover costs us, it would wake us all up, I think.
Well, it's crazy. It really is. And it's, you know, I think a lot of the turnover, there's two folds for turnovers, and it's different in both hard house and the front house. Front house, generally service staff are just supplementing, using it to supplement income while they've, you know, study or they move on to something else.
Yep.
To a career.
Yeah. A real job.
A real job.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. Winds me up. Yep.
And heart of house, the kitchen folk, It's turnover because they're really treated like shit a lot of the time. And they move from kitchen to kitchen to kitchen.
Yeah.
Service staff usually move from restaurant into their, you know, real job, quote unquote. And so there's a big issue there. And that's where we're trying to figure out right now, you know, how do we break down, how do we, you know, this inequality in pay is what's driving it. People will go to another kitchen for an extra 25 cents an hour.
Yeah.
Regardless of maybe, you know, some extra benefits you might get.
Yep. Yeah.
And so we've got to really try to figure that mess out.
So let me ask you this question, point blank, maybe unfair.
Bring it on.
So our Mike and I, our research through UGSERP, our paper we published on tipping in Ontario showed that servers make $18 an hour on average in tips, plus their $10 minimum wage, so they're making $28. And servers are making cooks are making $13.14. So, yep. You know that. You just stated the same thing. So, the front of house is making twice as much as the heart of house. The endemic problem of cook shortage is insane across the country. I read about it, people call me, etc.
Dealing with it right now.
If we flipped it around and cooks made $28 and servers made $14, would the problem then be you could find lots of cooks but you couldn't find servers? Let me ask you that. That's
it's an interesting question because you can find people to work at a lot of fast casual places.
Mm-hmm. Right? Making $12 an hour.
Making $12 an hour. Yeah. Yep. They can fill up the Tim Hortons. Yep. And they can fill up the McDonald's and everything else. So, that's the big issue, right? And there are people who want to be in kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
We just hired a guy at one of the Borealis who was – he's been a drywaller for the past 2 years, but worked in kitchens, but just didn't get paid enough money. And he's actually come back.
Wow.
He likes our business. He likes the business model. He likes our company. But he's getting paid less money because he just misses it that much. And there's people who really want to get in there, but he just can't afford to. Or it doesn't lend themselves to raising a family. Yeah. It doesn't lend them to do – they're living below the poverty line and everything else. And I think we know what the root of the problem is. And it's the distribution of gratuities. Okay.
Yeah.
Our restaurants, 75% of our sales are food, yet 80% of the gratuities, 85% of the gratuities go to the server.
Yeah.
And it's always been such a huge thought in our minds that, well, the servers make less than minimum wage. So we need to reward them for their service. We have to make up the poor servers.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not picking on the service staff out there at all because you know they're the most important part. And
yep.
I don't want anybody to leave, please.
No,
but there's no question about the value. There's a big issue, right? And there's a huge issue there. We've made a big change at the Woolly again. We can change our tip out again, and just to increase tip out rates to the kitchen. And mm-hmm. generally, you're looking about $1 for every hour.
Yep.
You're getting tip out. Yep. Well, our pub runs around $3 to $3.50 an hour.
Yep.
Tip out.
Which is significant.
Our average wage there is about $14, so we're about
$17. Yep.
We've been fighting recently trying to figure out, you know, how can we get people to a living wage?
Mm-hmm.
And that's $16.50 in Guelph.
Yep.
Which is the same as, you know, Kitchener-Waterloo.
Yep.
It's not much higher, believe it or not, in Toronto. I don't know how they calculate it, but it's just based on two people earning, you know, working full time,
mm-hmm.
being able to support two children,
mm-hmm.
I think the ages of 3 and 5,
mm-hmm.
and you know, to pay for rent, food, to get your kids in some extracurricular activities.
Yeah, it's the bare minimum. It's really, you know, it's seriously
zero
it's,
savings.
Yeah, no, it's
zero savings.
It is, yeah.
And you know, we can drop that living wage down to $14.95 if we pay health benefits, which is not okay. Well, we do pay for health benefits if they're with us for over 2 years. We essentially pay 100% of the health benefits for any employee who works over 20 hours a week. And see my plug there?
Yeah, yeah, that was good.
If there's any cooks out there,
I think six resumes were just emailed to.
But the But the what I'm trying to say is the, you know, that wage of, you know, we don't want to hit the bare minimum of trying to do $14.95 per hour, mm-hmm. including benefits. And $16.50 still isn't a lot, but at least it's something.
Yeah.
And we're trying to calculate that whole mess to get everyone in our kitchens up to a minimum of $16.50 an hour plus health benefits. And essentially, we were almost there, but there was one big component that was missing. Now there's been a wrench thrown in the plan with
minimum wage
increase,
going up, yeah.
which is
in the province of Ontario, which
is, you know, I'm for it all. You know, we all have to figure it out. But the other, you know, the big piece of the plan to get this to incorporate tips to a higher tip out mm-hmm. is obviously the service staff.
Yeah.
And you toy around, you know, I hate tipping. I worked in Australia. There's no tipping. I made more money in Australia than I did serving in Canada. I probably actually made more money in serving in Canada, but I spent a lot of it.
Right.
In Australia.
Because it was cash.
I was getting paid $18 yeah. an hour. I got paid penalty rates. So after 8 o'clock at night, I get an extra buck an hour. Saturdays yeah. was $20 an hour and Sundays was $25 an hour.
Yeah.
You know, there's incentive to work, you know, those off
shifts,
hours.
Yeah.
And I was able to put a lot of money into the bank, and we've got, you know, a lot of servers and cooks working paycheck to paycheck. But if the service staff realize how much money they're making, and our restaurants average out to almost $35 per hour.
Right, and our research shows that servers are actually cognizant that cooks don't make enough, and they are very willing to give up a portion of their tips. You know, how much is the question and stuff. And
that's it.
Yeah. Let's I'm going to say we'll move on from compensation.
Sure.
Because we could be here until tomorrow and Molly has schoolwork to do and things. So, okay. So I was a couple of weeks ago in Copenhagen, as you know, and I went to Restaurant Relais, and it was amazing experience. And the food was good, but really it was and I did write a blog called One House at Relais. It was 15 people working in this restaurant. And the first thing that you noticed was they all wore the same uniform, including one of the owners who was working as an order taker or server that night. The dishwasher, the sous chef, the cooks, the two servers, and there were only two servers. They took the order and did the wine service. Everyone else did everything else, including coffee and tea service. And talk about open kitchens. This place is actually, the kitchen is right there when you walk in the door. It's not even an open kitchen because it's there. You're part of it. And we were lucky enough to sit right where the action is right there and watch the theater of, we couldn't figure out who was in charge that night. Now it is a prefix set menu. You can get the 9-course or the 13-course or whatever, but we couldn't tell who was in charge. We couldn't distinguish roles. And that was the most amazing thing. First of all, they were all in the same uniform, like a bib apron, and different people were running the food to us. So two servers, everyone else was culinarily trained and was working or had been working in restaurants as cooks, etc., but loved the fact that they were running food out and talking to customers and that their efforts were, you know, Fogo Island, the inn at Fogo Island, the servers, whoever makes the food, the cooks runs the food to the table and they tell you about it. So is there an engagement level that can be gained between people doing different jobs and not only from, you know, allowing cooks, et cetera, to come out, but maybe putting people that are working in the front into the back, actually touching the food and making the food. And can we gain knowledge, expertise, professionalism, increased quality of service by doing that? And it's not easy and it would look different in every place, but is there value for an operator to do that, do you think?
I think they're 100% because, well, even in our restaurants, it's funny, we you know, our full management training program, you have to go through all the different stations in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And that training program lasts, you know, just a few weeks.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, good to go.
Yeah.
And really, you know, to be fair, it should be, and it, you know, it's kind of embarrassing to say because it's such an old school model, how we run things, but everybody should be able to work everyone's position in there, right? And it's hard to take one of our senior managers and say, go run that kitchen.
Right. Okay.
But I could probably take one of the you know, chefs or sous chefs to at least go supervise the floor.
The dining room. Yeah.
You know, there's I could limp through a service.
Okay.
I couldn't put a front of house manager back in to call
the
call
the line.
Call the line.
Yeah.
It would be a total disaster.
Okay.
Some of them have experience to do that, but.
So this gets to financial issues as well. So, and this is the economic idea behind the model. So I ran a very large restaurant at Bayview Village, you know, $6 million a year, 6,000. And we had 5 front of house managers and 4 chefs and sous chefs. And on a Monday night, we might do 100 covers, but we had, you know, a chef and 2 front of house managers. And really, I only needed one person there. You know, and I think back to my Red Lobster days, we were trained to do both kitchen and front. So if you were a manager, you could cover both, and there was that productivity and that money to be saved by having these managers. Now, Red Lobster is very regimented, recipe'd, it's boxed off, it's not chef driven, etc. But you know, can we gain productivity? And I've had chefs tell me that, you know, we don't need a GM and a chef here. I could run the whole place. You know, that's $80,000
mm-hmm.
for an operator, right? At least, right? Like, can you see as moving to, you know, radically changing how we?
Well, I think everybody has to understand each person's position,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I know a lot of restaurants out there that are, you know, chef run
mm-hmm.
that maybe have not survived. Okay, and so
people skills, you know, and leadership,
depending on what you want to do.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Do you like being a forward-facing person or not?
Yeah.
And so I think it's all personality-based, and it's going to work for certain people. You know, there's times for myself, I love being out in the public and touching tables, and I got to a point where I just wanted to work into the kitchen.
Right.
You know, I love expediting.
Yep.
People don't like me expediting, but I love to be.
I know you like expediting. Yeah. Yeah.
Probably hear my voice across the restaurant. I'm the worst example. But there is, you know, it's the server going working in the dish area,
mm-hmm.
and it's everybody helping out with each other, and you find that in a lot of you know, small mom and pop type places where everybody is doing the job
they have
to get
by,
and that's where we get that divide is because mm-hmm. people start thinking, well, I'm a server and that's mm-hmm. not my job, and
mm-hmm.
You know, I'm the cook, you know, learn to put an order in properly,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so it's We have created that divide. We're 100% guilty of it because we've put, okay, this is, you're good for this and you're good for that.
Yeah.
You know, you walk in the door and I already know, oh, this is someone applying for the kitchen or this is someone applying for the
front of house.
Team.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, we have this mindset of how it is.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily true. I've made the same mistake too. Oh, are you applying for the kitchen? No, I was actually a bartender. You look at the resume, you're going, oh, wow, you've got a lot of great experience. my mistake.
Yeah.
You know, it has become such an issue now, and we've separated. And I think that's, you know, people have become so specialized in their fields that nobody knows how to
do everything.
To do everything.
Yeah, no.
You know, we barely know how to communicate with each other properly.
Yeah, I would agree.
And so there has to be a shift, and there has to be, you know, that stepping stone. And I hate how it's always, oh, you start as a dishwasher and then you get to become a prep cook.
Yeah.
And then maybe, oh, you know, you cook and then, okay, then you can become a host.
Yeah.
and then you become a server and you work your way up this
chain, this food chain. Yeah, I did it. You did it.
And that was always it. It's like, I got to work to get out of here. And, you know, maybe someone wants to be a dishwasher.
Yeah.
And we're toying around now saying, okay, how about we just have one wage?
Yeah.
We just have this one wage, no matter if you're a server or if you're a dishwasher.
Yeah.
That's just one wage. That's it. Everyone makes the same doing this.
Yep.
You want to become a supervisor, whatever department you want to be in. Okay, there's an extra bump,
mm-hmm.
and maybe we take tip out, and we get back to tips. Sometimes I always think, do we take this evil entity and make it work for us, and just take the tips and distribute it ourselves? Like we could do that, mm-hmm. right? Without mm-hmm. changing everyone's buying patterns, mm-hmm. we can just say, you know what, I'm taking it, and this is how it's being distributed,
mm-hmm.
and. But going, you get tip out here and then an extra tier. So it's encouraging people to want to try to do more. But if you're still, if you wanted to wash dishes, if you wanted to bus tables, or you liked hosting, you still weren't being necessarily punished for it. Yeah. You still made enough money to get by.
And so as a researcher on tipping, there's all the negative things about tipping, but the one you've just said, I think it is really limited innovation. Because you have it gives you limits, right, as to what you can do. Amanda Cohen at Dirt Candy in New York is paying pretty much what you said. Everyone's making the same thing. From what mm-hmm. I understand, everyone makes $20 or $25 an hour, dishwasher, cooks, etc. Everyone is happy, etc. But it's hard to do within this concept of gratuity.
It is. And, one advantage, and maybe I'd say disadvantage, that New York has – disadvantage for them and advantage for us in New York, you're not allowed to touch gratuities.
No,
as an operator.
Yeah.
And so we're looking at the Danny Meyer models and mm-hmm. we're looking at Amanda Cohen and what they're doing and mm-hmm. going, this is great. But they're kind of forced because they can't take this extra income that's coming in that's being given to them.
Nope.
And we can.
Yeah,
we can distribute it.
I can't take it yourselves. You can't take it. No, but
take
you can.
Anything,
yeah,
but
that's, yeah.
It is... there's the average in what Ontario is 14.7% now of average gratuity.
Mm-hmm.
It's higher in our restaurants, but we're given this opportunity to distribute it.
Yeah.
And it's then trying to find, there's always the us and them part. I like how we've kind of come back to gratuity again.
I know. And I brought us back to that. And it's like, that's the last thing I wanted to do.
But there's a way to create change. And I don't think it's a operator coming in and saying, I'm going to take your tips from the service staff and switch it over. Do you know who has the biggest influence on that change?
Who?
And it's not the consumer.
Oh, okay.
It's the server.
It's the server. Okay.
Server has the opportunity. And I would love it if our server staff became leaders in this movement of taking gratuities and saying, we're going to make a stand and we're going to give more of this gratuity to the kitchen to level the playing field.
Yeah.
Can you imagine, though?
Yeah. No,
instead of me being, comparing myself to Danny Meyer, which I'm nowhere even close. As being that Danny Meyer is a big leader in this movement, what happens if you just took a restaurant and said the service staff voted?
Yeah.
To make this change happen.
Yeah.
It's power in numbers, and I think you could create some more change. I don't know if, gratuities are still an evil thing, but I think if you were to get a team of servers in a bunch of restaurants.
Can you imagine
to
that?
Say,
I know.
We're going to make this change. What's that going to do to the kitchen staff?
Yeah.
That work there.
Yeah.
You're going to be pretty pumped up.
Yeah.
And if we can equal that through a movement of people mm-hmm. instead of by an individual, I think we really have a huge opportunity there.
Well,
I hope we can figure it out. I want to do it in the restaurants and put it to a vote, and an anonymous vote, and just say, can we do this increase? Here's the discrepancy between the two. We know there's a discrepancy. Here's what it is.
Wow.
This is what's going to take to bring it up there.
If you ever do that,
let's vote
watch.
On it. Let's vote on
that.
It.
Yeah.
Let's vote on it per...
Yeah.
Per restaurant, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
And if we don't get there, at least we're trying to figure out ways to do it, because there's an advantage here. And I think changing the consumers, I listened to Donna Dewar on the last show, there's 18 million people are dining out a day.
Yeah. Well, and so,
there's a massive income that's coming into here, and we control it.
Do you know what, too? Angus Reid did a poll last year, and it showed – you know, almost 40% of people in favor of getting rid of tipping. 46 wanted to keep it, I think, and it was 38 that were in. But that's a lot higher than in previous surveys. So I think there's a movement. I think there's a movement. But speaking of moving, we're going to move away from tipping.
Yes,
that I brought.
100%.
Yeah, yeah. And have Molly stop kicking me under the table now.
She's pretty violent.
I know, yeah. So one house again. There's productivity issues maybe, and let me bring this experience I had with a restaurant called About Time, which was in Vineland, and they've since closed. But you know Dan Speck,
yes,
from Henry Pelham. He and I were there for lunch one day, and Dan brought his own amazing I think it was Chardonnay we had with lunch. And the chef came out, and I figured he's the chef owner, and he took the bottle away. He came and opened it, and then another chef cook came and took our order, and I was sort of wondering. And so we called the chef over, and he said, yeah, you know what? I opened up 3 years ago, and I had four servers in the front and four cooks in the back, and I did my 100 covers, and I was for lunch, and I was losing money. So I closed, I tried to sell, I couldn't sell, I reopened, and I said, to hell with having eight people, I'm going to have five people, and they're going to do everything, and they're going to seat. And so we were sat by the chef at the, you know, and it was fine. There was a sign that said, we'll seat you, and they took our order, they ran our food, they opened our wine. There's a restaurant in Encino, I forget the name, that has eliminated servers. Dominique Cren at Petit Cren has somewhat done the same with the thinking, not only the engagement we spoke about earlier, but this idea of productivity where at certain times the front of house is busy and the back of house isn't. And at other times it's the other way around. So can you start job sharing and redesigning work and roles to save money? Because again, going back to this idea that full service is in challenging times, I think redesigning the model and redesigning roles may be a great way to save money. What do you think about that?
I agree with that. I think it's restructuring how the kitchen operates.
Right.
And if there's, you know, making a switch to having, I think less, there's always so much pressure on the folks in the kitchen, or just having, you know, that one house mentality where everybody is able to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
I would try to think of how to run it in our restaurants currently like that. And I'm just going, oh, man.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt there.
Sure.
And one of the reasons is the physical divide.
It's physical divide.
Yeah. And this is what got me in Relay, because it was wide open. So there wasn't a physical divide. So you and it was interesting because one of the professors from Aalborg University in Denmark, where we were at this conference, spoke about servicescapes and people in design. And she was actually an architect who had then got her PhD and was teaching. But she talked about flow. And there was a restaurant over there, a Michelin 3-star called Geranium. And I mentioned this to Molly because of her work on employee health and wellness, et cetera. They were actually having their staff go through dance lessons. And they had a dance teacher come in and work with them and talk about movement. And so in the design of their restaurant, they incorporated the movement of people, of staff. And I've opened restaurants. Designers are not thinking about
seats.
Yeah. Yeah. So is the physicality the barrier, Court? Is that?
Well, that's how we've designed it, right? And that's why we have the terms back house and front house.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's back and there's a front, and you know, that's where the food comes out of. But you think of dinners at home
in the kitchen, right? Like you're sitting,
that's
right there,
biggest gathering place.
Well, Donna Dewar, I think Donna in the last episode of One House, which you mentioned, I think she talked about that.
She did too. Yeah, you're right. She did. And but that was always a gathering spot.
Yeah.
And for some reason we just hide it in the back of so many places.
Yeah.
And it's loud and it's, you know, but I think there's a lot of excitement in the kitchens. And there's a lot of places that do obviously have open kitchens out there. Now physically for a lot of our restaurants, it'd be pretty tricky. We're looking at ways of, you know, how can the service staff take on more?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, looking at, Do I need a dishwasher during the daytime? Can the service staff
do the dishes?
Do the dishes.
Yeah, run the dishes.
And too. While the cooks focus on getting everything ready.
Yep.
The service staff are the ones running the plates.
Yep. What about the cooks answering the odd phone call and not having to have a hostess come in? And this is a I'm still amazed.
They do it in our restaurants.
They do. Okay.
Yep. For the most part.
Yep.
There's some times where you call yep. and you're going, I know there's somebody there. Yeah. Maybe it's not a manager. But there has to be more of that forward facing. And it's taught on both sides, right? It's
because we are facing minimum wage increase, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in Canada in the industry, it's happened in Alberta, and I was speaking to Restaurants Canada out in Calgary last year. It's happening in Ontario. It's going to happen across the country. And everyone is focused on this number, but they're not thinking about creative solutions. And I'm
so that's what we're doing. And there's is kind of twofold. We're looking at other possibilities, obviously cleaning. We have cleaners coming into the restaurant. So having more responsibility put on to the service staff, predominantly to do a lot of cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just opens your eyes a lot more. Because then you start to really focus on the business. And that's where we've really gotten away from creating all these different departments that mm-hmm. we just – our eyes become so narrowly focused on just, our little
section.
Oh,
this person can't do this. And this
as
person.
Opposed to, man, I just cleaned this up yesterday and why is it already a mess?
Yep.
You take a lot more pride into those things. And that's what's being lost. That understanding of what other people's jobs are. I'm not saying that everyone needs to start cleaning and scrubbing toilets, but I clean toilets in the restaurants.
Yeah.
And, that's pretty much my primary job. But it's one of those things to try to understand. And the reason why is because I used to have to clean up toilets. That was my job.
Yeah.
I came in, I opened a restaurant, and it was making sure the toilets look good, mop the floors, and after service, that's what you were doing. And I don't know if it's we've become busier. It's an interesting question.
I asked this woman who served as a few plates at Relay what her role was. She's like, are you saucier? Are you garde-manger? She's like, I don't really have a role.
I do it all.
Yeah. We
help each other.
Yeah. We work as a team. And that's why we couldn't figure out who the hell. Interesting enough, I want to make this point too. So it was a Friday night, full restaurant. Obviously, they're doing two seatings, full Michelin one star, etc. I asked who the chef was. Oh, chef's not here. He worked lunch, right? Oh, chef's not here on a Friday night. No, he just works lunch on Fridays, right? The head chef, and that would be, I don't want to say unheard of, but
it's something we're trying to figure out.
Yeah,
We're all as you've I've just come back from traveling around in Europe, and you have as well. And you come back to North America and going, what are we doing to ourselves?
I know.
And
yep, true.
We're consumed with people not being able to do their job properly, and not letting people make their own mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's also not that we're unforgiving, but people are unforgiving. Mm-hmm. Guests in the restaurant are very unforgiving too. If we don't have a good service, I'm always terrified of how many bad reviews are we going to get from OpenTable to TripAdvisor mm-hmm. to Google, whatever else. There's so many options now. So it's almost this fear that's consuming us that this person can't do this job properly because this person is specialized here. And if we don't have this person on this night, it's going to be bad. So let's call in some extra people.
I think that's a really good, valid point.
And, yep. You have a, like you were saying of your trip, that sense of calm.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very frantic here. And we're always concerned of what people are always going to think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's trying to make that shift. People, once you start making some of those changes and, I keep going back to the Woolly because it's a tiny little kitchen.
It is really tiny.
And it's an old house. It's Guelph's longest running house party.
Yep.
And you've got the servers that all run around. The servers can bartend. They can do whatever.
Yep.
The guys in the kitchen, our kitchen manager doesn't have to be there on a Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have to be there on a Saturday night because
mm-hmm.
everybody knows the stations. They're so tight, closely knit.
Mm-hmm.
you know, such a small space, but everybody can work each other's jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where, you know, the hierarchy of the restaurants is what's really at fault as well too.
And,
you know, here's the chef and this is this person. Here's this person. That's a manager. He's, you know, that's a host.
You know, and you know what?
A host is a server one night.
Yeah.
And next night it's a different server,
so here,
because they're all making the same amount of money.
Here's where, and you've mentioned this, but if two different listeners to this podcast, one runs a 300-seat, $6 million-a-year corporate chain restaurant, and the other runs a 40-seat independent, the independent's going, oh, yeah, I could do this, and we do that. And the corporate guy's or girl is saying, oh, we're too big. We can't. But I want to question that corporate business model of, you know what, we're too big. We're too corporate. We're all about consistency. Our brand promise is – I think there's meat on the bone there. I think there's room. I think and I would argue that they need it more
100%
than anyone else. They need to rethink.
They are the ones that are going to
yeah.
to create a change. And I look at ourselves, you know, we're 160 employees. You know, we need to be making some of those changes as well. But is it that fear factor?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that one restaurant out in Calgary that, you know, changed kind of their model a little bit. And didn't work.
Nope.
That scared me a little bit. I was really excited about it.
Yep.
And we have to try to figure this out as a group. And that's one problem with our industry as well, too. We don't really talk with each other.
No, we don't.
And it's all about competition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about working with each other. And I always looked at, you know, I'm paying a host, you know, $11 an hour. $150 an hour, and they've. If I just put a server up there, you know, necessarily, you know, pay them less, but they're making gratuities, and they can do so much more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's having this rotation and saying, okay, four shifts you're working here,
yep.
and your one shift you work here, and we all work there together.
Yep.
I think that's where the where that meat is. I'm saying, hey, we have a rotation. And it's even, you're going to work 3 days here, you're a host, and you're working, you know, dessert section. And maybe you're working, you know, graduating into line. And
now,
the reason why there's that change is, once again, is the pay.
Is the money. And you will do this like everyone else where and this is what Mike and I found out in our research when we were talking to some servers who were managing 1 or 2 days a week. And they really wanted to be managers, and they would manage one or two shifts, but they couldn't do it full time because they couldn't take the pay cut. And the restaurant was, you know, paying them $17 or $18, but then they would give them the best sections on the night that they were serving to make sure that they compensated for. And I did that, mm-hmm. right? I've done that. I've did that my whole career. And if you think about that, you know, that is really messed up. We have people, I have students who are going out, who have gone to school 4 years to learn this profession, to be a manager. And they go, and one of the studies we did showed that they were leaving after a year or two because, you know, and then because they couldn't make enough money.
That's right? It.
And they would then go to college and get a serving job to pay for the college as they'd retrain in something else. And it's this vicious cycle. It's funny how we keep getting back to.
but that's, you know, it's a one house thing, but it's finding the people who are going to, you know, how do you get away from the pay cut?
So if everyone, right? if everyone was making $20 an hour.
Of yep. a pay cut is, yep. and it's crazy because it really isn't that big of a pay cut.
So let me ask you this. So if everyone in your dream restaurant was making $20 an hour, do you think it would be easier going to them saying, you're going to work 2 days serving, 1 day bar, 1 day host, and 1 day cook?
100%.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Of course, because I think you're still going to find people that are just passionate about cooking. I think
right.
you want to have those people.
For
you
sure.
Know, your chef is passionate about cooking, and they're the ones, the driving force, and they're the ones who are, you know, the creative force of the menu. And you've got your beverage person who's your cocktail
creator. Do you think that passionate cook who actually, let's say they're working at Fogo Island or Raleigh, or, and they run the food out to the table and put it down in front of the customer. Do you think they make better food consistently because they have to do that? Do you think they're focused because they actually meet the person who's going to eat their food? Do you think they're better?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Because they are, you know, it's that pride. Am I?
They're not serving the server anymore. They're serving the customer, right?
Taking it right to you.
Yeah.
And this is what I put on the plate for you. And I think there's that where the hesitation is.
Yeah.
For somebody working in the kitchen to work out front.
Yeah.
And vice versa, you know, someone working out in the front to work in the kitchen going, I can't do that.
Yeah.
And what a skill it is to cook great food.
It is.
You know, it's such an impressive skill. There's barely anybody cook up there, and yet it's one of the lowest paying professions out there.
Well, and I will say, though, that we are churning out more culinary school graduates in this province than ever before, Court.
Well, it's amazing the investment that's going into these schools and the colleges.
Oh, you've seen them.
It's crazy.
They're wonderful places, and I think they do a good job.
And I feel so bad when they come and work in the kitchens and maybe they've learned to make cheese and that's their passion. We're not making cheese here today.
Yeah, no.
You know, it's trying to find out what you can afford to do on a business model we're tied to. But I agree. If everyone's on a even playing field, people are way much more willing to try new experiences.
Let me ask you this as an educator. If we, being the colleges and universities that are teaching and training hospitality culinary students, if we could do one thing better for you in industry to prepare students to help you, and this is getting a little off topic, but we were just talking, what would it be? Is there something that jumps out at you?
I think it's getting the real life experience at the beginning instead of the end of their education. Because I think what's happening, a lot of students are coming in and they're learning about all these great systems and great companies in the world and all these, you know, a very philosophical view of the restaurant business. And then in their fourth or fifth year, they go and do a co-op and going, what have I done for the past 4 years of my life?
Yeah.
As opposed to giving them a real experience at the beginning and going, this is how you change it.
Yeah.
Here it is. Here's a really bad situation. Here's a good situation.
And now take all this experience and work
how
you
can. How do we change it? Yeah. And I think we have a complete messed up
view. We are almost doing things backwards.
That's why you see so many people leave the industry.
Yeah.
They get into it and they go. And we've got to give people that real experience. I always joke around. I worked in a restaurant business my entire life, for the most part, a few years in the beer business.
And some DJing.
And some DJing and things. And I went to apply to a school to go into their hospitality program. And I was not accepted into it.
Right.
Because I didn't have the grades for it.
Right.
And, or I didn't have the credits for it. And so I didn't do it. And I thought, wow, you know, one place I really wanted to go to teach myself and learn or be able to change some things from within I wasn't able to do. And that's where I started thinking, you know, people need to work in the business at the beginning of this.
Yeah.
To understand not what they're getting themselves into, but to understand the dynamics of how
context
work.
And then be able to have a context, then you can apply what you're learning to a real experience. And I would agree with that. And I think it's interesting because one of the future podcasts I want to have is with another educator or two and discuss this topic. So we'll be doing that. Molly gave me the signal. We reached an hour. So we're going to wrap up.
Sure.
And any last, you know, prolific, not to put any pressure on you, you know, that will have people stopping in their cars, pulling over the side of the road to listen to about One House and about this. Is there something?
Well, one thing I've always found fascinating in restaurants when guests come in there is nobody ever seems to care and just go right back to tipping. Seems to care where their money is going to once they put the tip on there. And I love it for people just to ask that question in the restaurant, because that's where you're going to start creating a dialogue of people discussing it. And, you know, the consumer is just as guilty of this. It's this hidden little dirty
secret. Yeah, it is, yeah.
That nobody no one talks about. And just say, where does all the gratuities go to?
Yeah.
Just start creating that conversation, because I think we can, you know, once servers start hearing it and the truth comes out, then I think that's when some change is going to happen.
So there is a restaurant in the U.S. somewhere, as I came across, that actually had two lines, and one, or they mentioned somewhere on the bill that this percentage was going to the kitchen. My thinking was, what if you had two lines where you could say, tip the kitchen, tip the server? Would that change things? That's like...
Or you could divide your tip.
Or you could divide your tip and say 40% goes to the kitchen because the food was so good, or whatever. That might, my God, I can't believe.
But I've worked as a server and said, here's my gratuity, and said, here, can you give five bucks to the kitchen folk?
Holy cow. I bought beer. In the old days, I would always send a bucket of beer if we could, or to the kitchen for after their shift. That was the thing. Court Desitel, thank you. It's been, you know, we could go on for 3 hours at least.
We probably will after this.
We'll turn off the mic. Molly, turn off the mic now. Neighborhood Group, Molly's going to put all the information on your great company and a few words about you on the website. So thank you once again, and I look forward to watching your journey further.
Thanks for having me on here. Really means a lot.
Thank you very much for tuning in to our second episode of One House. Check back in a week or two as we interview Kyle and Ben, two grads from the Hospitality and Tourism Department here at the University of Guelph, about their thoughts on One House.